Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's Saturday night. It's time for our weekly Dhamma talk and gathering and meditation. Monks have come together. Most of the monks have come together. And the lay community and many lay people visiting. And it's a time, it's an opportunity for us to reflect on Dhamma, to listen to some Dhamma teachings, to remind us probably of things we already know on one level. And yet we manage to forget, to ignore, to neglect that which we know. And this seems to be an extremely common trait. Formal times of exposing ourselves to the teachings, whether it's determinations to study a little bit every day or a little bit on a regular basis, whether it's listening to Dhamma on a regular basis on the Saturday nights, on the one pras, perhaps at your home, at your kuti, to have these structures which we use to override the habits that we tend to get caught in. This tendency to get caught up in momentum of things that are not necessarily directly related to the goal, to the highest purpose of our human life. So these structures, these forms, these traditions, these rituals, ceremonies are very important. A few of us were talking about this morning, and discourse came to mind that's tangentially related to this issue. The Buddha's talking about the conditions for the non-decline of a monastic, of a monk. And he gives a list of seven things which conduce to the non-decline of a bhikkhu. For everybody here, I think most of us anyways, these will be a very familiar list. At least a lot of the content will be, we have heard it from other lists and other kind of discourses. Very similar discourse, the Buddha talks about the conditions for the non-disappearance of the Dhamma. Actually, to be honest, I've never quite seen this list of seven. I've seen the list of six, I've seen the list of four, but I've never seen this list of seven, and it incorporates a bit of both. So I'm able to just say a few words on that tonight, just to bring it to consciousness. What are the seven conditions that help contribute to the non-decline of a monk? Here we can just think of a non-decline of a practitioner, somebody who's taking the Dhamma seriously, somebody who's said it in their mind that they have a purpose for their human existence and they want to fulfill the Buddha's instructions, they want to commit themselves to the Buddha's path. So for one, such a one, what are these seven conditions? The first one, it's, you know, at the head of the list, perhaps it would be rash to say it is the most important, because certainly for the first three, they seem to all be obviously integrally related. But it's reverence for the Buddha. So one has reverence for the Buddha. Just to think, to give yourself some time to think what that means, to have reverence for anything. What is reverence? And when you have reverence for something, certain kind of attitudes and moods come to mind. A mood of intense loyalty, a mood of, to a certain extent, awe. A mood that this is something that you uphold high in your life. And compared to that which you revere, everything else that you don't revere just fades into the distance, into the background. So when you revere something, everything else is trivial in comparison. And there's enough kind of images that the Buddha gives and kind of similes about the Buddha's specialness. And I don't feel that for myself, it's never come across as a kind of ego trip or like a power trip, and not by any means. It's, in fact, on the contrary, it's simply whenever the Buddha speaks about his own special qualities, it seems to come across to me that he's just revealing the way it is. And it just happens to be so that the Buddha is a remarkable being. And he gives, there are various kind of things that he says in this regard. He says things like, of all the beings in the universe, whether sentient or non-sentient, or conscious or not conscious, four-legged, two-legged, with form, without form, of all the beings in the universe, the Tathagata is the highest. And just to recollect that is inspiring. Everything else in our life fades into the background. The Buddha comes forth in a very prominent way. The heart is stirred, it's moved, there's energy in one's being. One feels attentive. A feeling of great respect arises. Just bring this to mind. And yet at the same time, it would be remiss to say you don't have faith in the Tathagata, faith in the Buddha, simply because he says you should have faith in him. I think that, like, there are those for whom, if they were to look at their life and not admit that they have faith in the Tathagata, would be a great moral failing. A sign that they're neglecting or denying what they know is true. And then there's others for whom, for them to admit or to declare or to commit some kind of faith in the Buddha would be a sign of gullibility, because there has not been adequate investigation. They don't really know what it is they have faith in. So the extent to which each one of us has to commit, and the number of fibers of one's being that one is going to commit to this path, for each one of us, it's the challenge is different, because we have a different level of understanding, and that particular point where faith becomes a gullibility. That exists. There is a point where faith is being gullible. And then there's also a point where non-faith is self-denial. And that's different for every one of us, and only we ourselves can look at that, and we have to look at that for ourselves and proceed in a way that is upright. So following closely on from that faith in the Buddha, a reverence for the Buddha, the second thing that leads to non-decline for a bhikkhu is reverence for the Dhamma. And, you know, what immediately comes to mind for myself and probably many who are listening to this talk is that lovely passage after the Buddha's awakening. And he says, for someone who doesn't live in reverence and deference to another being or to something, that person lives in misery or lives unhappily. I can't remember the adjective. And then he kind of looks at the world and he looks at himself and he says, but you know, he didn't say you know, but he says, one should dwell in dependence and deference on another being for the sake of fulfilling an aggregate of virtue that is not yet fulfilled, or for the sake of fulfilling the aggregate of mental stillness, concentration, samadhi, that has not yet been fulfilled, or for the sake of fulfilling the aggregate of wisdom that has not yet been fulfilled. And I see no one in this world with its gods and its demons and its Maras and its Brahmas and its monastics and kings. I see no one who has more developed these qualities than myself. And so therefore, I shall live in dependence and deference and reverence to this Dhamma which I've just awakened, to which I've just awakened. So when I think of the Dhamma is has this quality, this it's like I think of it as this strange image just comes to mind spontaneously. It's like the inverse of a black hole. It's like this quality of truth and goodness and virtue, which is just absolutely packed, and it's simply emitting endlessly these qualities of the Dhamma, of truth, of compassion, purity, wisdom, and it's simply, in the same way that a black hole sucks things in, this is just producing it. The Dhamma is just producing these things, or it's just kind of pouring forth. And it's like an inexhaustible source of it's like a certain vantage point on life or understanding, and it's this inexhaustible source of truth. This word suchness, it seems almost like from one perspective, it can seem like. It's not really clear what that means, suchness, and it doesn't exist that much in the suttas, but the Dhamma, just the way things are, there is a reality, and when you study the scriptures, there's this sense that you're in the presence of this reality, even though it's coming to us through the generations, you know, it was written down 2,000 years ago or a little more, perhaps. Still, this when you open the texts and you look at the Dhamma that's there, or when you have certain experiences in meditation, in your own contemplation, you feel yourself in the presence of corresponding reality, there's the sense of being in the presence of something infinite and infinitely great and special and valuable. Something that to praise it is to praise something that is extraordinarily meaningful. And to uphold it, to bring it to mind, is to bring to mind something that has a purpose. It's tremendous power. And this force of compassion and goodness and truth that comes forth from the Dhamma. And again, the Dhamma is just simply something that the Buddha has awakened to. You know, in many passages in the scriptures, he says, you know, whether the Buddha arises in the world or not, like this truth of Dhamma, this truth of many different truths that kind of are encapsulated in this word Dhamma, dependent origination, conditionality, the Four Noble Truths. These are things that exist whether the Buddha awakens to them or not, whether he declares them or not, whether we realize them or not. These are truths that are fundamental and eternal truths of conditioned existence. So that's, to me, that's very inspiring. And certainly that's what I want to awaken to, is something which is which transcends the comings and goings of sense contact and sense experience. And so to have reverence for the Dhamma involves the willingness to study the Dhamma. And the Dhamma, of course, has this kind of dual meaning. It's both what is represented in the scriptures is one aspect of Dhamma, a very important aspect of Dhamma. But then also what is our experience of existence, the truth of the way things are. This is also Dhamma. There's this other passage that's very nice, and the Buddha says, four kinds of beings exist in the world. There's one who has studied little of the Buddha's teachings and is not intent on the teachings. There's one who has studied little of the Buddha's teachings but is intent on those teachings. There's one who has studied much of the Buddha's teachings but is not intent on the teachings, and one who has studied much and who is intent on the teachings. And he goes on to say, what does this mean? So one who has studied little and is not intent on the teachings is one who hasn't really studied much, hasn't put much interest in learning the Dhamma, and that which he has learned, he doesn't understand. And he hasn't penetrated with view. And then there's the one who has studied little but is intent on those teachings. And what that means is, here he studied little, but that which he has studied, he's understood. And he lives according to what he understands, and he's penetrated. And then you can extrapolate what the other two would mean, to study, to know a great deal of the teachings, but you don't really penetrate them, you don't understand them, you're not committed to them. And then the highest, of course, is to have studied much and to have penetrated those teachings and to live accordingly. So the Dhamma is studying the Dhamma and living according to the Dhamma. These are very related concepts. And so the Dhamma is something to revere. The third, of course, would be the Sangha. Beings who essentially have awakened to these truths, to the truth of the Dhamma, who've purified the heart, freed the mind from the asavas, from the taints of becoming. Beings who essentially attest test that peace and wisdom is possible. Beings who essentially have penetrated the Buddhist teachings and not even necessarily teaching them. That's not really the point on one level. The point is that somebody who has gone through the work, and it is a work, somebody who's gone through the work of looking into their own heart and seeing where the defilements are, and to have gone in the other direction, to go away from the chaos and the confusion that selfishness engenders, and to be going in the other direction, and to have actually arrived at a place where the defilements are at rest, not through suppression, but through peace, through understanding. That's somebody who has gone through the work. They've done what had to be done. And so that's very special. The question arises, of course, well, how do you know who's the kind of noble Sangha and who isn't, who's enlightened and who's not? And this is kind of a thorny question. And all you can, I think the only way you can respond to that is you have to, based on your own best intentions, based on listening to beings that you trust and respect, you have to forge your way and trust your intuition. I don't really see how I can, what kind of wiser response that can be given to that, because you can't say, look, you know, so and so is an arahant, therefore you should believe, trust that, you know, just because I say so and so is an arahant doesn't mean he is, of course, not by any means. I mean, how many arahants exist in this world? The point of that is, like, many people think either they're arahants or they know arahants, or they, how many people think they're enlightened, or, you know, if you look at the modern bookshelf, bookstore, so it can be almost worrying. So the other day we had the visitor, Ajahn Dunn was here, Ten Ajahn Dunn, somebody who's very highly regarded in our Sangha. Somebody who, when you listen to him speak, you sense that this is somebody who's speaking from experience. He himself admits he's never been really intent on learning a great deal, like studying much. He's not a study scholar monk. And he's somebody who strikes me as somebody, perhaps, I don't want to say he hasn't studied much. I've just heard secondhand that he hasn't studied much. But he strikes me as somebody who falls into that category, perhaps, of maybe not having studied much, but he's somebody who's penetrated the teachings. He's taken what he has studied, what he has learned, and applied it. And he's somebody who's has a reputation for very uncompromising in his own practice. And to hear stories of his practice is quite awesome. And he gave a talk here a couple nights ago. It was a one prof. And it was a long talk. And it was cold out. It was very cold. It was windy. And it just was a long, long, long talk. And, you know, it's what struck me is the most impressive thing about that was that just his enthusiasm for the Dhamma. He put Dhamma, he had such reverence for the Dhamma that he put it ahead of everything else. He put it ahead of fatigue. He was certainly, he's been very busy while he was here. He's been doing a lot of talking and teaching. He put it ahead of his own physical comfort. It was cold. He said later that it was very cold. Sometimes I notice in myself, I'll be frank, sometimes the kind of whining mind is kind of, it's cold and this talk is going on such a long time. But of course, it's like, well, what's more important? Like you're listening to the Dhamma. This is the words of the Dhamma. And whether it's the Dhamma that's coming from somebody who's studied the texts, even that is valuable. Even that is special. But in his case, it was more than that. It was somebody who's experienced. So that's reverence for the Dhamma. Putting the Dhamma ahead of everything else. The next four are nice because they're kind of slightly, they're just interesting. There's perhaps at least some of them are not quite what you would expect. The next one is reverence for, well, I can't quite remember the order of the next four, but reverence for samadhi. And it's funny that he would single that out. Concentration is difficult, and it's difficult to feign. It's like, or to deceive oneself. You, in general, if your mind is not concentrated, you know it. And if your mind is solid as a rock, you know it. Whereas wisdom, it's very easy to deceive yourself with wisdom. It's very easy to have all kinds of insights that you think are special and perhaps aren't maybe all that special. It's very difficult to have any kind of perspective on wisdom. It's possible to be having actually some blazing insights, but just because it's part of your being for so long that you may not even give it the due importance that it deserves. So samadhi is something that it's cultivated through work and through hard work. It's not easy. And question was asked in with Ajahn Dunn. We were gathered together and we were talking about samadhi. And he was saying what an important aspect it is of the path. And someone asked the question, what about when you're studying and the mind can get very focused studying? You kind of get into very kind of intent on what it is you're concentrating on and very focused. And does that qualify as samadhi? And just without even hesitating, he goes, no. No, it's not that's not even... it's good to study, for sure. He wasn't saying it's not good to study. But when we're talking about samadhi, this kind of samadhi that is going to go into the depths of one's mind and see the subtlest movements of mind and self-deception and the subtlest intentions that are moving within one's being, it takes great stability and stillness and strength to see that. And I think I'm just musing, speculating here, but perhaps one of the reasons the Buddha singles it out from time to time as being really so important that it's one of the things that we're supposed to have reverence for is because it is difficult, it's easy to kind of skip over it. It's easy to think, well, maybe I'll just kind of cultivate wisdom, or maybe I'll just kind of say to myself, that's not that important. I seem to be getting along pretty good without it, and so forth. And the Buddha is saying, no, it's extremely important. But it's hard work, and we also have to have the humility to it's not a problem. Let's say some of us, we feel that our samadhi is not together. And that's not a problem. It's not a problem because it's like you have a mango that comes out of a tree and it's this very small little mango and it's green. And you don't blame the mango for not being sweet or not being ripe. It's what it is. It's a mango and takes time to develop to become sweet and ripe. And when it comes to samadhi, or in fact any aspects of the path, it's the same kind of thing. You can't blame. It's not a problem that you are where you are, even if you're at the very beginning stage. That's okay. I mean, it's better to be where you are and just to accept that and to own up to that than to sort of have these ideals in your head that you're going to constantly be striving at and constantly failing, but somehow think, comfort yourself by saying, well, at least I have these high ideals. Certainly, high ideals are great and valuable, wonderful. But it's also, we have to remember, we are where we are. And samadhi comes about through reverence for it. And reverence for it over many years and many lifetimes. That's okay. That's the way it is. I mean, it's not the case. Most of us maybe will not be enlightened in this lifetime. That's okay. That's not a problem. That doesn't mean we should pack it in. That doesn't mean the path isn't efficacious. And it's my personal feeling that samadhi is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, and it's the one that's easy to neglect. It's easy to skip over. So, samadhi, and again, samadhi is not just simply having the moment, you know, having your mind in flow, as it were. I mean, I have a conversation with somebody some time ago, and they said, well, you know, my meditation, because I don't actually sit down and meditate, but I golf. And for me, that's meditation. Okay, I understand. Golf can be calming and it can be pleasant. And these days, I mean, obviously Buddhism has no monopoly on this word meditation. It's used in so many different ways out there. But when it comes to samadhi, you know, that's referring to something very specific. And that's not simply a state where the mind is in sort of the peace of golf. You know, it's something a little bit more profound. I don't mean to be belittling golf here. Another one of these other things that we should have reverence for that contribute to the non-decline of a bhikkhu or a practitioner is reverence for heedfulness. So heedfulness, this is the path to the deathless, the Buddha says. And this is an interesting one for me because obviously, heedfulness, I've never, you know, had a problem with it, or I've never been sort of discouraged heedfulness or anything like that, but I've never brought it to mind as an object of reverence, whereas I think all the others in this list I have. And but to think of heedfulness as being something that you should really kind of hold up high, and not just as a concept, but to recognize where is it in your life, like what beings exemplify heedfulness. And I can think of a monk, for instance, or a few monks. I'm sure everyone here can think of a few monks who just seem to embody heedfulness. And heedfulness is not fear, not in a like a neurotic kind of fear. Heedfulness is simply recognizing that the specialness of the situation that we're in, and the opportunities that are present in our life. And the sense that, okay, time is precious, and I want to value that, and I'm going to value that by making the right choices that honor the value of this human existence. And it's fun, okay, you know, I take it back, actually. I say I've never held up heedfulness as an object of reverence, but I can say that there, like, when I've met beings who strike me as really specially heedful and composed, I've often had this image it comes spontaneously to my mind, even if it's a junior monk or a layperson. When I see that sort of heedful kind of humbleness, I can almost feel my hands or my heart. It's as if I can almost see my hands going angelic in my heart. And that's even if it's like a layperson, but if they embody this quality, it's it arouses that sense. So anyways, this is something for us to reflect on, is to recognize where is heedfulness in our life. And maybe you can not think of it as I have to be more heedful, but rather where is heedfulness present, whether it's within oneself, we're all heedful to some extent, or within one's life, that heedfulness may be represented in other beings or other beings that one may share one's life with. Heedfulness, carefulness, caring for what is special in one's life. Not treating that which is valuable with casualness, as though it doesn't really matter, as though it's if I lose this particular situation or this particular person, it's no big loss. That's the sort of attitude that can be, I think, quite tragic. And it's not doing honor to the situation that we're in as human beings, B, as beings who've come across the Dhamma, C, beings who've found like a community that is practicing well, reasonably well. This all points to things that is actually very, very special, I think. Okay, one of the two last ones is the training. The training and this obviously makes sense for bhikkhu. We have the Padimokkha rules, the sikha, the training rules that we undertake, and obviously if we're not going to decline in those training rules, we have to hold up those training rules high. And bring them to mind, to recognize these aren't just like kind of rules that are just kind of drummed up by somebody on a power trip. These were proclaimed by the Buddha with very, and he enumerates his purpose in laying down the rules. This is that wonderful list of 10 rules. Again, we talked about this today, the ten reasons for laying down the Patimokkha. And so the Patimokkha, the rules that the monks live by, if you look at them, you'll notice they seem to have different purposes. Some are moral rules, like, for instance, not to lie. That's a moral rule. Some are purely, not to be offensive to the lay community. There's many different reasons for laying down the rules. And the list of 10, I won't go through all 10, but just like for the excellence of the community is one, just for the intrinsic excellence of a community that is keeping the rules, that's an excellent community. For the arousing of faith in lay people that don't have faith, that's another reason that he laid down these rules. Or for the increase of those who do have faith, for the increase of faith. Or for the, he's actually to keep us from, us as monastics, to curb the asavas, you just think of it, the unwholesome states, to reduce the unwholesome states in this life. And also for the sake in future lives, he says, is so that in the future lives there'll be less. I mean, these are every one of these kind of purposes for the fostering of discipline, for the realization of truth. Every one of these purposes is kind of motivated by compassion. You can see that if you look at it, you study it. These are compassionate intentions. Not to mention very broad and visionary. With great vision. So for monastics who have undertaken the training, it's to dwell in reverence for that. For lay people to also, these are not just there's the training that lay people undertake for it's the five precepts. That's actually a training. You know, you can think of it if you're a Buddhist practitioner that this should be a kind of conscious part of your life. It's like working with the five precepts, and that's a project. It's not easy. It doesn't come necessarily for most people. It doesn't come naturally. And it's how to hold something like precepts is a delicate matter because on the one hand they're serious. They're serious things. On the other hand, you don't want to get. It's not about guilt tripping anybody. So just learning how to relate to the precepts, to the training, it's an important project, and it reverence for the training is key. At least that's a key. It's a necessary condition for progress in the training. And then lastly, and this is the sort of, it's almost like a twist in the plot. One has reverence for hospitality. So, as a monastic, we're on the receiving end of a mind-boggling amount of hospitality and support. And you can only imagine how inappropriate and how harmful it would be to one's spiritual progress to take that for granted. At the same time, lay people are on the receiving end of hospitality from monastics, insofar as there's teaching, insofar as there's ever an act of kindness that is shown to you by monastic or otherwise, wherever kindness comes, to recognize that immediately. And to see it, to be humbled by it, to appreciate it, to value it. And one of the things that is interesting, so as monastics we have all kinds of protocols. When visiting monks come to a monastery, there's ways that we're supposed to receive them. And recently I was in Sri Lanka. And most monasteries that I went to, there were forced monasteries, they were good monasteries, and they had these protocols kind of very well developed. And you get to the monastery and monks would come and they would kind of take my bags and other monks would kind of run off and get drink of water, and they'd come out and it would be on a tray. And certainly one of the first reflections that comes to my mind, and here it's so easy to neglect that because we don't get visiting monks anyhow very very often, but whenever hospitality is shown is to immediately sort of make a promise to oneself that one will return that when one has an opportunity, when the opportunity is present. Especially where this becomes really obvious is where, let's say you're in the middle of doing, you're wandering as a monastic, you're out wandering, you're hot, you're thirsty, you're tired, you're exhausted, and someone shows you an act of kindness. Somebody pulls over by the side of the road and they offer you some water, what have you, something like that. And there's this feeling that it was so valuable, that little act of generosity, that particular layperson or person. And it can flood the heart. And they can just pull over by the side of the road, they kind of, you know, hand you a bottle of water and then they drive off. And you feel overwhelmed with gratitude, and they have no idea how powerful their act of kindness was. And at the same time, sometimes I think, you know, it's certainly as a monastic, as a wanderer, you're in a situation sometimes when you're wandering, and you're cold, and you're hungry, maybe you didn't eat that day. You come into a town, you don't know where to stay, and people maybe look a bit suspicious at you because they don't know what a monk is. And it can be a very sort of intimidating feeling. And of course, this is what, say, homeless people feel all the time, something like that. They're hungry, they don't know where to go. And it's like, certainly I've had the feeling where we're not allowed to ask for food or anything like that. And there's this feeling, you see the whole world from a different perspective. Everybody's going by, everybody looks so happy, they look so content, they look so rich, and they all look well fed. And you're just thinking, just one sandwich would be so appreciated. And you think to yourself, you know, all it would take, you just look at people, and I'm kind of exposing some of my inner workings here, but you just look at people going by and you think, oh, all it would take is just like one, you know, it would be so easy for them to just, you know, buy me a sandwich. And of course you don't, you know, you mindfully, you reflect on that and you position of a monk, okay, you know, I'm not going to follow, I'm not going to make any hints, you're just going to keep kind of going. But certainly, that must be what, say, homeless people feel all the time. And they're right, probably. We live with incredible luxury and relative luxury and comfort. And it would probably take so little to help and to make other people happy. And yet, few are those, to quote... poet, few are those with help to lend. And very few of us have the emotional wealth and we shouldn't simply demand of ourselves that we're generous or more generous than we can muster. I think that can lead to a sort of strange, maybe unhealthy relationship to generosity. You don't want to push beyond your limits of generosity, but simply to revere, to appreciate how valuable generosity can be, both for your own heart and being generous, as well as for whoever it is that you're being generous towards. And the benefit of the generosity is almost never necessarily the material object that you're giving. That's simply the conduit. I mean, what's really valuable is the heart and the love and the care that is being channeled through that act of giving or thoughtfulness. So hospitality, that's the last of this list. Let's see if I've got all seven here. So there's Buddha, reverence for the Buddha, reverence for the Dhamma, reverence for the Sangha, reverence for... I think actually the fourth one is the training, reverence for concentration, for samadhi, reverence for heedfulness, and reverence for hospitality. These are seven things that lead to non-decline of a bhikkhu. So I'll offer that for your reflection this evening.